This is Abundance. I am your host, Dane Allred. Today, we'll talk about ultimatums. It's number 914 from my list of 1,001 things I'm thankful for that I call 1,001 Thanks. Ultimatums. Be careful when you issue a threat. It will come back and bite you, I bet. Scowling and fuming, those threats can be dooming if you can't follow through on it yet. Anything happened on the way to Dane Allred? Foot race. I need to get running again, since I'm almost positive I'll be running in the St. George Marathon this October. I've tried to enter the race the past 2 years, and they have a three times in your in rule. I didn't used to like jogging, but I've learned it's a wonderful way to exercise, and it does help me focus on what really needs to be done during the next few days. My wife used to jog with me, and she still stays in shape by dancing. The last race we ran together was the Art City Days race, which is usually held in early June. This has been more than 20 years ago, but I still remember who won the race. This was back when the Art City Days race used to follow the parade route. It was fun since people were waiting for the parade and people from town would cheer you on. I like to enter this race because it's early in the summer. It's a great way for me to start my marathon training. There does seem to be a race every weekend somewhere in the county, so that means I can run at least once during the week. If I run every race during the weekends of the summer and do some distance work, it really does get me ready for the big one, the marathon. I'd always wanted my wife to run a race with me, and she agreed to run this one time. I was super excited. I hoped this would be a way for us to keep in shape. So when we left the starting line, she sidled up to me and said, "Would you please run with me? I don't want to run by myself." So what devoted husband could resist a plea like that? I throw myself on the mercy of the court. There really are only two choices. I could run at my usual pace, which was faster than she was running. I'd been in many races by this time, and she was running her first. If I ran with her, then I'd be running at a much slower pace than usual, but if not, she'd be running alone. Case closed. We trotted along together at a comfortable pace, and all along the way we saw friends and neighbors. We waved and felt very good about the exercise we were getting, and everything was right with the world. And since this is the old race route, the end of the race was also the end of the parade just down the street from our house. It ended at the old Pizza Hut, which is now an insurance firm. We were literally steps from the finish line when I realized something was about to happen. You need to know that my wife comes from a very competitive family. Her dad was a football, swimming, and track coach. Let's just say they don't like to lose. It's a nice way to say it, and if I say it nice, I won't have to sleep on the couch tonight. Well, there we were, just yards from the finish line. There's a little boy running in front of my wife. I'm running just behind her. I want to run ahead and beat her to the finish line, but I have to do some quick mental calculations. Will it make her mad if I beat her? I speed up a little bit to test the waters. Now remember, she's not a regular runner, and she speeds up. Well, the gauntlet has been thrown. I sped up and tried to sprint ahead. It really is a sad picture if you think about it. A wife and a husband who every other day of the year will support each other in sickness and in health, for better or worse, for richer or poor, to love and to cherish, unless they are entered in the same foot race and inches from the finish line. Unfortunately, she was just too fast for me. She sprinted ahead, but she still let the little boy beat her, but not her husband. Now, don't misunderstand. We weren't racing for first place. We weren't going to be crowned the champions of the Art City 5K. I don't think we were even going to place in our respective divisions. They have different categories for age and gender, for which I'm very grateful. I've placed as high as second when there have only been two 40-year-old males in my category. And on this day, I would finish second place in my family. My wife has forever been able, after that, to claim that she's the fastest runner in our family. She sped across the finish line and announced her retirement from foot races. To this day, she's never run another race. Listening to Abundance. I am your host, Dane Allred. Today we celebrate the abundance all around us by saying thank you for the multitude of blessings and opportunities we enjoy. Join with me in this expression of thanks by contemplating ultimatums. It's number 914 on my list of 1,001 thanks. You've just heard Foot Race from A Funny Thing Happened on the Way to Dane Allred. Today on Abundance we'll visit Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement and hear about some car wrecks. Also on Literature Out Loud, we'll begin an audio version of Jack London's White Fang and listen to Ultimatums from Brightspace. We'll wrap things up with Marry Me from Dane Allred's Partly Colored Dreamcoat. Today on Abundance, we'll examine Ultimatums. It's number 914 from my list. I call 1,001 thanks. It's a list I've compiled to show my gratitude for all the abundance I see around me. I hope to help you see that abundance. Remember, we are the abundance we seek. Why would I be grateful for ultimatums? When the gauntlet is thrown down, most of us rise to the occasion unless the wife happens to be too far ahead. But when life deals out tests, we as a people usually rise to the occasion. Here's hoping your ultimatums are met with the respect you deserve, and the ultimatums you are given are more successful than my foot race. This combined expression of thanks is available anytime at DaneAllred.com, an audio version with complete text of everything you hear. Sit back and enjoy the abundance I find, and you may find the abundance in your life too. Right Space by Dane Allred. Ultimatums. We were given a challenge. We thought we knew all there was to know. We were content in the bright space. But then we discovered there was more to know. The only way to know all there was to know was to come here, alone and apart from all we knew there. We would have to leave each other and the comfort we knew in the bright space. Apart, we would be able to experience what we could not experience together. We were given an ultimatum. Stay together, peaceful, content, happy in our ignorance, or leave that place for the unknown. To stay or leave. When given a choice to try something new, to go to the unknown, not knowing what we would face, if there would be happiness waiting for us or disappointment. Without assurances, without a guarantee, we went bravely into our future, hoping to find out what we could do, what we could learn. When we face those same kinds of decisions today, we experience the doubt we felt back then. The fear of the unknown sometimes keeps us in the safe place, the place we know, the place we have always known. That fear keeps us waiting, undecisive, unable to explore what could be, what might be, what we might find in our future. But as we bravely face our future, much like we face the decision to come here and do all we were meant to do, to accomplish all we were meant to accomplish, we can look to our past decisions to help us know what to do tomorrow. When we step one step into that future, we will find those same friends we knew there. We will feel the connection, and together we will be able to learn all there is to know and be together again. But this time, we will have learned all there is to know because we accepted the challenge. The peace, happiness, and joy we knew there will be ours again. Dane Allred's Rules of Engagement, Car Wrecks. I was the world's worst beginning driver, getting in six car accidents during just my first year driving at the ripe age of 16 and a half. I tried to get my license right after my birthday in January, but when Mom took me down, it was snowing pretty hard, and we were there early. The driving test administrator didn't think they would be doing any driving because of the snow, but because we were there and must have looked desperate, he said he would take me out driving. It was snowing so hard I couldn't see across the mega medians they have in downtown Salt Lake. So as I slowed to see the lane I was supposed to be turning left into, the light turned red. I wasn't informed until we pulled back up at the Department of Motor Vehicles. "He turned left on a red," the lugubrious tester said. Then he turned to the other staff in the building and said, "We won't be doing any driving today." I decided to wait to get my license until there was absolutely no chance of snow. I passed the test in July. That was a long 6 months to wait, but at least I passed without trying to find the left turn lane in blowing snow. I almost immediately began to have car accidents, all caused by me. I made up for the delay in getting my license by backing up into another car while trying to get out of a parking space. I swear the other car wasn't there when I looked back, but then you never know when someone is going to pull up behind you and park while you pull out. I dented in her passenger side door pretty well, and the insurance rates started to climb. I don't remember much about the other accidents during the year until it was almost then the end of my junior year. I do remember packing a healthy lunch and actually brown bagging it for the first time in high school. I was so proud of that lunch and my decision to eat more sensibly. My usual lunch that entire year was a Suzy Q and a Fanta orange. Very healthy. As I pulled around the corner up on 9th East and Sandy and headed south toward Jordan High School, I turned right and had to accelerate to get in to the traffic as usual. The lunch bag fell to the floor. I reached down to rescue the golden cargo, and when I leaned back up, there was a large truck in front of me. The bumper was high enough to smash through my radiator and shove it against my engine. As I hit the truck without even putting on my brakes or being able to swerve, my head smacked against the steering wheel. The boondoggle wrapped around the cover slashed my head. Mom was at work, so when they asked who should come get me at the hospital, Grandpa Hale showed up just after they sewed 7 stitches in my forehead. It was all surreal, people trying to help me when all I had done was cut my head. A trip in the ambulance, more attention at the hospital. When it was over, I had a new scar and no car. I decided to go back to eating a little less healthy. I never packed a lunch again. I had one other miraculous accident I survived somehow. I had a Yamaha 150 motorcycle that didn't run all that well. It would go pretty well for about 10 minutes, but then it would start to sputter and probably only needed a tune-up, but I was a poor college student. I decided to go for a short drive up Logan Canyon, and as the bike sped up, it seemed to be running pretty well. I gunned the engine as I went down the steep hill and was going way too fast. Centrifugal force took over down at the bottom where the road turned, but the motorcycle did not. I drifted into the gravel shoulder going at least 25 or 30 miles per hour. The front wheel dug in and went sideways. The back wheel kept going forward and threw me over the handlebars. I did a complete somersault in the air and landed on my back, which is better than landing on your head. When I hear the adjective woomph, it makes me think of the landing on some more loose gravel. I sat there for a moment and soaked in the pain, but didn't recognize any broken bone pain. I picked up the motorcycle, drove it back to campus, and sold it for about $100 a week later. At least, no more bees would be smacking me in the face while going 50 miles an hour. Thank you. are listening to Abundance. Where else could you hear original writings and classical literature read out loud? Today, we are examining ultimatums number 914 from my list of 1,001 thanks. On Abundance, I'm so excited about the world I find myself living in, I've made a list of 1,001 things I'm thankful for, and I call it 1,001 thanks. Here's to those life-changing moments we call ultimatums, and the new path each of them sets us up on. Literature Out Loud, White Fang by Jack London. Part 1, Chapter 1, The Trail of the Meat. Dark spruce forest frowned on either side of the frozen waterway. The trees had been stripped by a recent wind of their white covering of frost, and they seemed to lean towards each other, black and ominous in the fading light. A vast silence reigned over the land. The land itself was a desolation, lifeless, without movement, so lone and cold that the spirit of it was not even that of sadness. There was a hint in it of laughter, but of a laughter more terrible than any sadness, a laughter that was mirthless as the smile of the Sphinx, a laughter cold as the frost and partaking of the grimness of infallibility. It was the masterful and incommunicable wisdom of eternity laughing at the futility of life and the effort of life. It was the wild, the savage, frozen-hearted Northland wild. But there was life abroad in the land and defiant. Down the frozen waterway toiled a string of wolfish dogs. Their bristly fur was rimmed with frost. Their breath froze in the air as it left their mouths, spouting forth in spumes of vapor that settled upon the hair of their bodies and formed into crystals of frost. Leather harness was on the dogs, and leather traces attached them to a sled which dragged along behind. The sled was without runners. It was made of stout birch bark, and its full surface rested on the snow. The front edge of the sled was turned up, like a scroll, in order to force down and under the bore of soft snow that surged like a wave before it. On the sled, securely lashed, was a long and narrow oblong box. There were other things on the sled, blankets, an axe, a coffee pot, and a frying pan. But prominent, occupying most of the space, was the long and narrow oblong box. In advance of the dogs on white snowshoes toiled a man. At the rear of the sled toiled a second man. On the sled in the box lay a third man whose toil was over. A man whom the wild had conquered and beaten down until he would never move nor struggle again. It is not the way of the wild to like movement. Life is an offense to it, for life is movement, and the wild aims always to destroy movement. It freezes the water to prevent it running to the sea. It drives the sap out of the trees till they are frozen to their mighty hearts. And most ferociously and terribly of all does the wild harry and crush into submission man. Man, who is the most restless of life, ever in revolt against the dictum that all movement must, in the end, come to a cessation of movement. But at front and rear, unawed and indomitable, toiled the two men who were not yet dead. Their bodies were covered with fur and soft tan leather. Eyelashes and cheeks and lips were so coated with the crystals from their frozen breath that their faces were not discernible. This gave them the seeming of ghostly masks, undertakers in a spectral world at the funeral of some ghost. But under it all, they were men, penetrating the land of desolation and mockery and silence, puny adventurers bent on colossal adventure, pitting themselves against the might of a world as remote and alien and pulseless as the abysses of space. They traveled on without speech, saving their breath for the work of their bodies. On every side was the silence, pressing upon them with a tangible presence. It affected their minds as the many atmospheres of deep water affect the body of the diver. It crushed them with the weight of unending vastness and unalterable decree. It crushed them into the remotest recesses of their own minds, pressing out of them like juices from the grape, all the false ardors and exaltations and undue self-values of the human soul until they perceive themselves finite and small, specks and motes, moving with weak cunning and little wisdom amidst the play and interplay of the great blind elements and forces. An hour went by, and a second hour. The pale light of the short, sunless day was beginning to fade when a faint cry arose on the still air. It soared upward with a swift rush till it reached its topmost note, where it persisted, palpitant and tense, and then slowly died away. It might have been a lost soul wailing, had it not been invested with a certain sad fierceness and hungry eagerness. The front man turned his head until his eyes met the eyes of the man behind. And then, across the narrow oblong box, each nodded to the other. A second cry arose, piercing the silence with needle-like shrillness. Both men located the sound. It was to the rear, somewhere in the snow expanse they had just traversed. A third and answering cry arose, also to the rear and to the left of the second cry. "They're after us, Bill," said the man at the front. His voice sounded hoarse and unreal, and he had spoken with apparent effort. "Meat is scarce," answered his comrade. "I ain't seen a rabbit sign for days." Thereafter they spoke no more, though their ears were keen for the hunting cries that continued to rise behind them. At the fall of darkness, they swung the dogs into a cluster of spruce trees on the edge of the waterway and made a camp. The coffin, at the side of the fire, served for seat and table. The wolf dogs, clustered on the far side of the fire, snarled and bickered among themselves, but evinced no inclination to stray off into the darkness.
"Seems to me, Henry, they're staying remarkable close to camp," Bill commented.
Henry, squatting over the fire and settling the pot of coffee with a piece of ice, nodded. Nor did he speak till he had taken a seat on the coffin and begun to eat.
"They know where their hides are safe," he said. "They'd sooner eat grub than be grub. They're pretty wise, them dogs."
Bill shook his head.
"Oh, I don't know."
His comrade looked at him curiously.
"First time I ever heard you say anything about their not being wise."
"Henry," said the other, munching with deliberation the beans he was eating, "did you happen to notice the way them dogs kicked up when I was a-feeding them?"
"They did cut up more than usual," Henry acknowledged.
"So how many dogs we got, Henry?"
"Six."
"Well, Henry..."
Bill stopped for a moment, in order that his words might gain greater significance.
"As I was saying, Henry, we got six dogs. I took six fish out of the bag. I gave one fish to each dog, and Henry, I was one fish short."
"Yeah, you counted wrong."
"We got six dogs,"
the other reiterated dispassionately.
"I took out six fish. One ear didn't get no fish. I came back to the bag afterward and got him his fish."
"We've only got six dogs," Henry said.
"Henry," Bill went on, "I won't say that it was all dogs, but there was seven of them that got fish."
Henry stopped eating to glance across the fire and count the dogs.
"There's only six now," he said.
"I saw the other one run off across the snow," Bill announced with cool positiveness. "I saw seven."
Henry looked at him commiseratingly and said,
"I'll be almighty glad when this trip's over."
"What do you mean by that?" Bill demanded.
"I mean that this load of iron is getting on your nerves and that you're beginning to see things."
"I thought of that," Bill answered gravely, "and so when I saw it run off across the snow, I looked in the snow and saw its tracks. Then I counted the dogs, and there were still six of them. The tracks is there in the snow now. Do you want to look at them? I'll show them to you."
Henry did not reply, but munched on in silence until the meal finished. He topped it off with a final cup of coffee. He wiped his mouth with the back of his hand and said,
"Then you're thinking as it was..."
A long wailing cry, fiercely sad, from somewhere in the darkness, had interrupted him. He stopped to listen to it. Then he finished his sentence with a wave of his hand toward the sound of the cry.
"One of them?"
Bill nodded.
"I'd a blame sight sooner think that than anything else. You noticed yourself the row the dogs made."
Cry after cry and answering cries were turning the silence into a bedlam. From every side the cries arose, and the dogs betrayed their fear by huddling together and so close to the fire that their hair was scorched by the heat. Bill threw on more wood before lighting his pipe.
"I'm thinking you're down in the mouth some," Henry said.
"Henry,"
he sucked meditatively at his pipe for some time before he went on.
"Henry, I was thinking what a blame sight luckier he is than you and me'll ever be."
He indicated the third person by a downward thrust of the thumb to the box on which they sat.
"You and me, Henry, when we die, we'll be lucky if we get enough stones over our carcass to keep the dogs off us."
"Yeah, but we ain't got people and money and all the rest like him," Henry rejoined.
Long-distance funerals is something you and me can't exactly afford. What gets me, Henry, is what a chap like this, that's a lord or something in his own country and that's never had to bother about grub nor blankets, why he comes a button round the godforsaken ends of the earth. That's what I can't exactly see. Yeah, he might have lived to a ripe old age if he'd stayed at home, Henry agreed.
Bill opened his mouth to speak, but changed his mind. Instead, he pointed towards the wall of darkness that pressed about them from every side. There was no suggestion of form in the utter blackness. Only could be seen a pair of eyes gleaming like live coals. Henry indicated with his head a second pair and a third. A circle of gleaming eyes had drawn about their camp. Now and again a pair of eyes moved or disappeared to appear again a moment later. The unrest of the dogs had been increasing, and they stampeded in a surge of sudden fear to the near side of the fire, cringing and crawling about the legs of the men. In the scramble, one of the dogs had been overturned on the edge of the fire, and it had yelped with pain and fright as the smell of its singed coat possessed the air. The commotion caused the circle of eyes to shift restlessly for a moment, and even to withdraw a bit, but it settled down again as the dogs became quiet.
"Henry, it's a blame misfortune to be out of ammunition."
Bill had finished his pipe and was helping his companion to spread the bed of fur and blanket upon the spruce boughs which he had laid over the snow before supper. Henry grunted and began unlacing his moccasins.
"How many cartridges did you say you had left?" he asked.
"Three," came the answer. "And I wished 'twas 300. Then I'd show 'em what for, damn 'em."
He shook his fist angrily at the gleaming eyes and began securely to prop his moccasins before the fire.
"And I wished this cold snap would break," he went on. "It's been 50 below for 2 weeks now, and I wish I'd never started on this trip, Henry. I don't like the looks of it. I don't feel right somehow, and while I'm wishing, I wish the trip was over and done with, and you and me was a-sitting by the fire in Fort McGurry just about now and playing cribbage. That's what I wished."
Henry grunted and crawled into bed. As he dozed off, he was aroused by his comrade's voice.
"Say, Henry, that other one that come in and got a fish, why didn't the dogs pitch into it? That's what's bothering me."
"You're bothering too much, Bill," came the sleepy response. "You was never like this before. You just shut up now and go to sleep, and you'll be all hunky-dory in the morning. Your stomach's sour, that's what's bothering you."
The men slept, breathing heavily side by side, under the one covering. The fire died down, and the gleaming eyes drew closer, the circle they had flung about the camp. The dogs clustered together in fear, now and again snarling menacingly as a pair of eyes drew too close. Once, their uproar became so loud that Bill woke up. He got out of bed carefully, so as not to disturb the sleep of his comrade, and threw more wood onto the fire. As it began to flame up, the circle of eyes drew farther back. He glanced casually at the huddling dogs. He rubbed his eyes and looked at them more sharply. Then he crawled back into the blankets.
"Henry," he said. "Oh, Henry!"
Henry groaned as he passed from sleep to waking and demanded,
"What's wrong now?"
"Nothing,"
came the answer. "Only there's seven of 'em again. I just counted."
Henry acknowledged receipt of the information with a grunt that slid into a snore as he drifted back into sleep. In the morning, it was Henry who awoke first and routed his companion out of bed. Daylight was yet 3 hours away, though it was already 6 o'clock, and in the darkness, Henry went about preparing breakfast while Bill rolled the blankets and made the sled ready for lashing.
"Say, Henry," he asked suddenly, "how many dogs you say we had?"
"Six."
"Wrong," Bill proclaimed triumphantly.
"Seven again?"
Henry queried.
"No, five. One's gone."
"The hell," Henry cried in wrath, leaving the cooking to come and count the dogs. "You're right, Bill," he concluded. "Fatty's gone."
"Oh, and he went like grease lightning once he got started. Couldn't have seen him for smoke."
"No chance at all," Henry concluded. "They just swallowed him alive. I bet he was yelping as he went down their throats. Damn him."
"He always was a fool dog," said Bill.
"But no fool dog ought to be fool enough to go off and commit suicide that way."
He looked over the remainder of the team with a speculative eye that summed up instantly the salient traits of each animal.
"I bet none of the others would do it."
"Couldn't drive him away from the fire with the club," Bill agreed. "I always did think there was something wrong with Fatty anyway."
And this was the epitaph of a dead dog on the Northland Trail, less scant than the epitaph of many another dog, of many a man. Thank you.
Literature Out Loud. White Fang by Jack London. Part 1, Chapter 2, The She-Wolf. Breakfast eaten and the slim camp outfit lashed to the sled, the men turned their backs on the cheery fire and launched out into the darkness. At once began to rise the cries that were fiercely sad cries that called through the darkness and cold to one another and answered back. Conversation ceased. Daylight came at 9 o'clock. At midday the sky to the south warmed to rose color and marked where the bulge of the earth intervened between the meridian sun and the northern world. But the rose color swiftly faded. The gray light of day that remained lasted until 3 o'clock, when it too faded, and the pall of the Arctic night descended upon the lone and silent land. As darkness came on, the hunting cries to right and left and rear drew closer, so close that more than once they sent surges of fear through the toiling dogs, throwing them into short-lived panics. At the conclusion of one such panic, when he and Henry had got the dogs back in the traces, Bill said, "I wish they'd strike game somewheres and go away and leave us alone." "They do get on the nerves horrible," Henry sympathized. They spoke no more until camp was made. Henry was bending over and adding ice to the babbling pot of beans when he was startled by the sound of a blow, an exclamation from Bill, and a sharp, snarling cry of pain from among the dogs. He straightened up in time to see a dim form disappearing across the snow into the shelter of the dark. Then he saw Bill standing amid the dogs, half triumphant, half crestfallen, in one hand a stout club, in the other the tail and part of the body of a sun-cured salmon. "I got half of it," he announced, "but I got a whack at it just the same. Did you hear it squeal?" "What'd it look like?" Henry asked. "Couldn't see, but it had four legs and a mouth and hair and looked like any dog." "Must be a tame wolf, I reckon." "It's damn tame, whatever it is, coming in here at feeding time and getting its whack of fish." That night, when supper was finished and they sat on the oblong box and pulled at their pipes, the circle of gleaming eyes drew in even closer than before. "I wish they'd spring up a bunch of moose or something and go away and leave us alone," Bill said. Henry grunted with an intonation that was not all sympathy, and for a quarter of an hour they sat on in silence, Henry staring at the fire and Bill at the circle of eyes that burned in the darkness just beyond the firelight. "I wish we was pulling into McGurry right now," he began again. "Shut up, your wishing and your croaking," Henry burst out angrily. "Your stomach's sour. That's what's ailing you. Swallow a spoonful of sody, and you'll sweeten up wonderful and be more pleasant company." In the morning, Henry was aroused by fervid blasphemy that proceeded from the mouth of Bill. Henry propped himself up on an elbow and looked to see his comrade standing among the dogs beside the replenished fire, his arms raised in objurgation, his face distorted with passion. "Hello," Henry called. "What's up now?" "Frog's gone," came the answer. "No." "I tell you, yes." Henry leaped out of the blankets into the dogs. He counted them with care and then joined his partner in cursing the power of the wild that had robbed them of another dog. "Frog was the strongest dog of the bunch," Bill pronounced finally.
"And he was no fool dog, neither," Henry added. And so was recorded the second epitaph in 2 days.
A gloomy breakfast was eaten, and the four remaining dogs were harnessed to the sled. The day was a repetition of the days that had gone before. The men toiled without speech across the face of the frozen world. The silence was unbroken save by the cries of their pursuers that, unseen, hung upon their rear. With the coming of night in the mid-afternoon, the cries sounded closer as the pursuers drew in according to their custom, and the dogs grew excited and frightened, and were guilty of panics that tangled the traces and further depressed the two men.
"There, that'll fix you, fool critters," Bill said with satisfaction that night, standing erect at the completion of his task.
Henry left the cooking to come and see. Not only had his partner tied the dogs up, but he had tied them, after the Indian fashion, with sticks. About the neck of each dog he'd fastened a leather thong. To this, and so close to the neck that the dog could not get his teeth to it, he had tied a stout stick 4 or 5 feet in length. The other end of the stick, in turn, was made fast to a stake in the ground by means of a leather thong. The dog wasn't able to gnaw through the leather at his own end of the stick. The stick prevented him from getting at the leather that fastened the other end. Henry nodded his head approvingly.
"It's the only contraption that'll ever hold one ear," he said. "He can gnaw through leather as clean as a knife, and just about half as quick. They'll all be here in the morning, hunky-dory."
"You bet they will. You just bet they will," Bill affirmed. "If one of them turns up missing, I'll go without my coffee."
They just know we ain't loaded to kill, Henry remarked at bedtime, indicating the gleaming circle that hemmed them in. If we could put a couple of shots into them, they'd be more respectful. They come closer every night. Get the firelight out of your eyes and look hard there. Did you see that one? For some time, the two men amused themselves with watching the movement of vague forms on the edge of the firelight. By looking closely and steadily at where a pair of eyes burned in the darkness, the form of the animal would slowly take shape. They could even see these forms move at times. A sound among the dogs attracted the men's attention. One ear was uttering quick, eager whines, lunging at the length of his stick toward the darkness, and desisting now and again in order to make frantic attacks on the stick with his teeth.
Look at that, Bill, Henry whispered.
Full into the firelight, with a stealthy sidelong movement, glided a dog-like animal. It moved with commingled mistrust and daring,
cautiously observing the men,
its attention fixed on the dogs. One ear strained the full length of the stick toward the intruder and whined with eagerness.
That fool One Ear don't seem scared much, Bill said in a low tone. It's a she-wolf, Henry whispered back, and that accounts for Fatty and Frog. She's the decoy for the pack. She draws out the dog, and then all the rest pitches in and eats him up.
The fire crackled. A log fell apart with a loud sputtering noise. At the sound of it, the strange animal leaped back into the darkness.
Henry, I'm a-thinking, Bill announced.
Thinking what?
I'm a-thinking that was the one I lambasted with the club.
Ain't the slightest doubt in the world, was Henry's response.
And right here, I want to remark, Bill went on, that animal's familiarity with campfires is suspicious and immoral.
It knows for certain more than a self-respecting wolf ought to know, Henry agreed. A wolf that knows enough to come in with dogs at feeding time has had experiences.
Old villain had a dog once that run away with the wolves, Bill cogitates aloud. I ought to know. I shot it out of the pack in a moose pasture over on Little Stick. An old villain cried like a baby. Hadn't seen it for 3 years, he said. Been with the wolves all that time.
I reckon you've called the turn, Bill. That wolf's a dog, and it's eaten fish many's the time from the hand of man.
And if I get a chance at it, that wolf that's a dog will be just meat, Bill declared. We can't afford to lose no more animals.
But you've only got 3 cartridges, Henry objected.
I'll wait for a dead sure shot, was the reply.
In the morning, Henry renewed the fire and cooked breakfast to the accompaniment of his partner snoring.
You was sleeping just too comfortable for anything, Henry told him as he routed him out for breakfast. I hadn't the heart to rouse you.
Bill began to eat sleepily. He noticed that his cup was empty and started to reach for the pot. But the pot was beyond arm's length and beside Henry.
Say, Henry, he chided gently, ain't you forgot something?
Henry looked about with great carefulness and shook his head. Bill held up the empty cup.
You don't get no coffee, Henry announced. Ain't run out? Bill asked anxiously.
Nope.
Ain't think it'll hurt my digestion?
Nope. A flush of angry blood pervaded Bill's face.
Then it's just warm and anxious I am to be here and you explain yourself, he said.
Spanker's gone, Henry answered. Without haste, with the air of one resigned to misfortune, Bill turned his head and from where he sat counted the dogs.
How'd it happen? He asked apathetically.
Henry shrugged his shoulders. Don't know, unless One Ear gnawed him loose. He couldn't have done it himself, that's sure.
That darn cuss!
Bill spoke gravely and slowly, with no hint of the anger that was raging within.
Just because he couldn't chew himself loose, he chewed Spanker loose.
Well, Spanker's troubles is over anyway. I guess he's digested by this time and cavorting over the landscape in the bellies of 20 different wolves, was Henry's epitaph on this, the latest lost dog. Have some coffee, Bill. But Bill just shook his head.
Go on, Henry pleaded, elevating the pot.
Bill shoved his cup aside.
I'll be ding-dong-danged if I do. I said I wouldn't if every dog turned up missing, and I won't.
It's darn good coffee, Henry said enticingly. But Bill was stubborn, and he ate a dry breakfast washed down with mumbled curses at One Ear for the trick he'd played.
I'll tie him up out of reach of each other tonight, Bill said as they took to the trail.
They had traveled little more than 100 yards when Henry, who was in front, bent down and picked up something with which his snowshoe had collided. It was dark, and he could not see it, but he recognized it by the touch. He flung it back so that it struck the sled and bounced along until it fetched up on Bill's snowshoes.
Maybe you'll need that in your business, Henry said.
Bill uttered an exclamation. It was all that was left of Spanker, the stick with which he had been tied.
They ate him, hide and all, Bill announced. The stick's as clean as a whistle.
They've ate the leather off from both ends. Oh, they're damn hungry, Henry. And I'll have you and me guessing before this trip's over.
Henry laughed defiantly. I ain't been trailed this way by wolves before, but I've gone through a whole lot worse and kept my health.
Takes more than a handful of them pesky critters to do for yours truly, Bill, my son.
I don't know, Bill muttered ominously.
Well, you'll know all right when we pull into McGarry.
I ain't feeling special enthusiastic, Bill persisted.
You're off color, that's what's the matter with you, Henry dogmatized. What you need is quinine, and I'm going to dose you up stiff as soon as we make McGarry.
Bill grunted his disagreement with the diagnosis and lapsed into silence. The day was like all the days. Light came at 9 o'clock. At 12 o'clock, the southern horizon was warmed by the unseen sun, and then began the cold gray of afternoon that would merge 3 hours later into night. It was just after the sun's futile effort to appear that Bill slipped the rifle from under the sled lashings and said, "You keep right on, Henry. I'm going to see what I can see."
"You better stick by the sled," his partner protested. "You only got 3 cartridges, and there's no telling what might happen."
"Who's croaking now?"
Bill demanded triumphantly. Henry made no reply and plodded on alone, though often he cast anxious glances back into the gray solitude where his partner had disappeared. An hour later, taking advantage of the cutoffs around which the sled had to go, Bill arrived.
"They're scattered in range and all, along wide," he said, "keeping up with us and looking for game at the same time. You see, they're sure of us, only they know they got to wait to get us. In the meantime, they're willing to pick up anything eatable that comes handy."
"You mean they think they're sure of us," Henry objected pointedly. But Bill ignored him.
"I seen some of them. They're pretty thin. They ain't had a bite in weeks, I reckon, outside of Fatty and Frog and Spanker. And there's so many of them. That didn't go far. They're remarkable thin. Their ribs is like washboards, and their stomachs is right up against their backbones. They're pretty desperate, I can tell you. They'll be going mad yet. And then watch out."
A few minutes later, Henry, who was now traveling behind the sled, emitted a low warning whistle. Bill turned and looked, then quietly stopped the dogs. To the rear, from around the last bend and plainly into view on the very trail they had just covered, trotted a furry, slinking form. Its nose was to the trail, and it trotted with a peculiar, sliding, effortless gait. When they halted, it halted, throwing up its head and regarding them steadily with nostrils that twitched as it caught and studied in the scent of them.
"It's the she-wolf," Bill answered.
The dogs had lain down in the snow, and he walked past them to join his partner in the sled. Together they watched the strange animal that had pursued them for days, and that had already accomplished the destruction of half their dog team. After a searching scrutiny, the animal trotted forward a few steps. This it repeated several times, till it was a short 100 yards away. It paused, head up, close by a clump of spruce trees, and with sight and scent studied the outfit of the watching men. It looked at them in a strangely wistful way after the manner of a dog, but in its wistfulness there was none of the dog affection. It was a wistfulness bred of hunger, as cruel as its own fangs, as merciless as the frost itself. It was large for a wolf, its gaunt frame advertising the lines of an animal that was among the largest of its kind.
"Stands pretty close to 2.5 feet at the shoulders," Henry commented, "and I'll bet it ain't far from 5 feet long."
"Kind of a strange color for a wolf," was Bill's criticism. "I never seen a red wolf before. Looks almost cinnamon to me."
The animal was certainly not cinnamon-colored. Its coat was the true wolf coat. The dominant color was gray, and yet there was, to it, a faint reddish hue, a hue that was baffling, that appeared and disappeared, that was more like an illusion of the vision, now gray, distinctly gray, and again giving hints and glints of a vague redness of color not classifiable in terms of ordinary experience.
"Looks, for all the world, like a big husky sled dog," Bill said. "I wouldn't be surprised to see it wag its tail." "Hello, you husky," he called. "Come here, you whatever your name is."
"Ain't a bit scared of you," Henry laughed.
Bill waved his hand at it threateningly and shouted loudly, but the animal betrayed no fear. The only change in it that they could notice was an accession of alertness. It still regarded them with the merciless wistfulness of hunger. They were meat, and it was hungry, and it would like to go in and eat them if it dared.
"Look here, Henry," Bill said, unconsciously lowering his voice to a whisper because of what he intimated. "We got 3 cartridges, but it's a dead shot. Couldn't miss him. It got away with 3 of our dogs, and we oughter put a stop to it. What do you say?"
Henry nodded his consent. Bill cautiously slipped the gun from under the sled lashing. The gun was on the way to his shoulder, but it never got there. For in that instant, the she-wolf leaped sideways from the trail into a clump of spruce trees and disappeared. The two men looked at each other. Henry whistled long and comprehendingly.
"I might have knowed it," Bill chided himself aloud as he replaced the gun. "Of course, a wolf that knows enough to come in with the dogs at feeding time would know all about shooting irons. I'll tell you right now, Henry, that critter's the cause of all our trouble. We'd have 6 dogs at the present time instead of 3 if it wasn't for her. I can tell you right now, Henry, I'm gonna get her. She's too smart to be shot in the open, but I'm gonna lay for her. I'll bushwhack her as sure as my name is Bill. You needn't stray far doing it, his partner admonished. If that pack ever starts to jump you, then 3 cartridges would be worth no more than 3 whoops in hell. Them animals is damn hungry, and once they start in, they'll sure get you, Bill. They camped early that night. 3 dogs could not drag the sled so fast, nor for so long hours as could 6, and they were showing unmistakable signs of playing out. And the men went early to bed, Bill first seeing that the dogs were tied out of gnawing reach of one another. But the wolves were growing bolder, and the men were aroused more than once from their sleep. So near did the wolves approach that the dogs became frantic with terror, and it was necessary to replenish the fire from time to time in order to keep the adventurous marauders at safer distance.
"I've heard sailors talk of sharks following a ship," Bill remarked as he crawled back into the blankets after one such replenishing of the fire.
"Well, them wolves is land sharks. They know their business better than we do, and they ain't a-holdin' our trail this way for their health. They're gonna get us. They're sure gonna get us, Henry."
"They half got you already a-talking like that," Henry retorted sharply. "A man's half-licked when he says he is, and you're half-eaten from the way you're going on about it."
"They got away with better men than you and me," Bill answered.
"Ah, shut up your croaking. You make me all fired tired."
Henry rolled over angrily on his side, but was surprised that Bill made no similar display of temper. This was not Bill's way, for he was easily angered by sharp words. Henry thought long over it before he went to sleep, and as his eyelids fluttered down and he dozed off, the thought in his mind was,
"There's no mistaking it. Bill's almighty blue. I'll have to cheer him up tomorrow."